history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that we're all going to be better off for hearing. But that means, first of all, we have to care. We have to take the time to ask a few questions, and most importantly, to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And by the time we're done, we realize that we've been educated, we've been entertained, and ultimately, we've been inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week, the world paused for Holocaust Remembrance Day. So many planned ceremonies and observances had to be canceled in this age of COVID-19 distancing. But we don't have to be physically together to pause and reflect, to make sure not only that history is not forgotten, but that its cautionary implications for the future are not missed. Over the years here on Hometown Heroes, we've heard from many veterans who came face to face with evidence of the Holocaust as they reached concentration camps throughout Europe in the spring of 1945. You can access all of their accounts online at hometownheroesradio.com. And for today's episode, we're going to hear from three men who came home from World War II with powerful perspectives on what the Nazi regime had perpetrated. We start with the very first camp to be liberated. That was Ohrdruf on April 4th, 1945. Ralph Rush was a 23-year-old with the Intelligence and Reconnaissance Platoon of Headquarters Company, 355th Infantry Regiment, 89th Infantry Division.
We were sent out on patrol one morning, very early, and we're told we might find something special, but we didn't know what it was for sure.
Huh.
But I think it was some of our air guys that spotted it. I was told to take my squad, there were just six of us, and check out this facility that they had been able to spot. And they gave me the coordinates and sent a tank with me, one tank. Then the rest of my guys that were, well, there was six of us in jeeps. And we spotted on the hill some fencing, metal fencing, and it was pretty heavy duty and pretty thorough height-wise. So we headed for it. The closer we got to it, the more we realized it was a big, pretty big place.
And this is April 4th, 1945. There hasn't been a single concentration camp liberated yet.
No,
or discovered by the Americans.
That's right. There was talk of something of that nature, but no specifics.
So you haven't heard stories, you haven't seen images, you have no idea what you're stumbling across.
No, not at all.
So you see the fence, you head toward it.
We head for it, and at the gate, I was first one in, and there were just six of us that were with weapons there. And here at the gate, inside, it's sort of a double gate, are six young men that had just been executed.
And you had heard something, I think, hadn't you?
Yeah, we heard some shooting, and so we went cautious as hell.
While you're on the way there, you heard shots, but you didn't see anything heading your way.
No.
So then you get there, and you see these bodies, and that tells you what the shots were?
Yep, there were six bodies. The blood was there and what have you. So it was just been done, like it was meant as a token to us or something of this nature, or a warning to us, whatever you might say. There's either six or eight. Three were Americans.
How could you tell?
The way their patches were on their arms.
They were in uniform.
They were in uniform.
So they had been captured.
They had been captured and then executed.
So that's a little alarming.
It shook us up pretty bad.
And who were the other ones?
They were British. But when we went in, very carefully because we didn't know we began to see like three or four football fields in a row, and down at the bottom of it, not quite all the way, but was a railroad track where they had been burning and were still burning bodies. There were headquarters building and all the rest of it there, and I didn't want us to get caught in a bad spot, so the six of us, I divided them up. You do this and do this and so on. And I went through the buildings that were there. There were some headquarter buildings to see if there's by any chance anyone there that would be. Well, I didn't know for sure what the hell we had.
Yeah, someone could be waiting to kill you.
Yeah. So we went by twos to the buildings. Mm-hmm. And they were fairly high buildings. So then we came down as it began to get lighter. Here were, and I've got some pictures of some of the bodies. What they'd done was taken prisoners, and I think these are mostly Germans who weren't Nazis.
Uh-huh.
They had been gassed or poisoned, and then their bodies were put in rail cars. They were sort of an open-air rail car, full, absolutely right to the brim, boxes of bodies.
I know you've told your story many times over the years, so you're used to describing this now. But at the time, as a young man who's never seen anything like this before.
God, it just really throws you. And we were six of us and quite a few of the Germans there. And I was concerned that we might be trapping ourselves. And we had to be pretty darn careful. But that's what was happening, was bodies are being delivered from some central point.
You saw these cars actually coming down the railroad.
And being burned.
So it almost leaves you with the impression that this is an effort to burn the evidence, to hide the truth of what had happened there.
Yes, you're suspicious of that. A young man, pretty sure he was Polish.
How old do you think?
About my age, maybe a little bit older than I.
In his 20s?
Yeah, in his 20s, maybe late 20s. He couldn't speak English, but he was doing his best to get our attention. He came up to me. He'd come up to one of my other guys, too. He came up to me and he said, in a language I couldn't quite understand, but there's enough so I could pick up, that he wanted a gun, because he explained to us that the Germans that were doing this final stages, burning the bodies and things of this nature and moving the bodies down to be burned, they are taking the clothing from the guys that they were using to burn.
So the Germans were basically hiding out in the uniforms that the prisoners had to wear.
Right.
So they're disguising themselves as prisoners, thinking that they can get away.
That's right.
And this is what this young Polish boy is telling you, but you've never met him before. You can't even really understand him, and he's asking you to give him a gun. How do you know he's not one of the Germans?
Well, that was a big decision I had to make. And I made the decision based on my hunch that he was right. So I gave him a gun, gave him some ammunition, I happened to have stopped a German on the way to the hospital some weeks before. He had a Luger on him and some bullets and all the rest of it. And because he said that, as I finally got to understand that the guys that were responsible for this thing, he convinced me anyway that what he was doing was right. I took the chance, gave him a gun, gave him some ammunition.
He takes the Luger and several clips of bullets.
Yeah, I could hear the shooting going on and so forth. So he shot quite a few people who were trying to get out, knowing that we were somehow knew we were there and that they were going to get hung or executed. He came out at the end. He was crying, and he said he'd used every bullet that he could find in addition to the bullets that I'd given him, because he found bullets on the guys that were working there in the yard. As I say, he was crying. It was dark by then. He'd been at it quite a while. I'd heard quite a bit of shooting going on. And he gave me a silver watch on a silver chain. And I told him that the war's going to be over before you know it, and you need to keep this for yourself, because it's about the only thing that you've been able to hide and keep. And he insisted I take the watch. It had a chain on it that was probably about a foot long. Beautiful silver chain and watch. Unfortunately, someone stole it out of my bag months later.
Mm.
So I didn't have it. But he insisted that I take the...
He just wanted to show his gratitude for your giving him the chance to do what he did.
To get even with some of the terrible people that were in that facility. It's hard to believe how big it was. I mean, it was about like 3 football fields or 4 football fields in size. It was a big operation.
And that's what I want to ask you about. So this whole time that he has borrowed this gun from you and is going out to find those who had been torturing and exterminating the prisoners and were trying to escape, what were you doing that whole time? Are you exploring the camp?
We're exploring the camp to see if we can't find out for sure what's going on and who was doing it.
What else did you see there that sticks with you today?
I think the thing that sticks with me more than anything is the bodies that were being prepared for the burning. There are so many of them, like you might see in a slaughterhouse. I have some pictures of them that make you ill almost to see.
Did you feel ill there?
Yes. It's so terrible. It's hard to believe that someone could, some group could do as many dangerous things as that and be so rotten. I mean, it just makes you feel like what you were doing was certainly worth the time and effort. Thinking of the bodies of the boys that were killed there, that we're sorry we didn't get there sooner, or something of that nature.
Yeah.
They had just been executed. Well, you feel like you'd like to be able to do something a little more penetrating. Hard to fathom, hard to believe that one person could do it to another. Just at such a scale, such an incredible scale. Terrible, terrible. And to figure that as we went along, how many more of those type of camps were around. But this had to be a major one.
It was the first one liberated, Ohrdruf, yeah. Have you ever been back there?
No, I have not.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but no. I've talked to so many guys who just witnessed a concentration camp. But you were witnessing the very first one that Americans stumbled across when bodies are still being burned. You're seeing the people that were killed and some that were left alive and the horrible state that their bodies were in, how malnourished and, you know, in what bad shape they are. Is that something that affects you still today, what you went through there?
Yes, it does affect me. I wake up in the middle of the nights still with the terror of what must have been given to all of those folks that were so terribly treated. You can't believe that person could do for another, those kind of things. It just, it's beyond comprehension. But once you see what I saw in that concentration camp, there's no room for, you can feel sorry for the people, but you can't feel sorry for the Germans that caused so much misery.
Have you ever encountered anybody who told you that they don't believe the Holocaust happened?
I've heard of people saying that, but no one's ever talked to me that's asked me that question or told me that they don't believe that the Holocaust occurred.
How would you respond?
I'd have to tell them that their source is pretty lousy, because believe me, it's the truth. It's not somebody's guess or somebody's over the night dreaming or something of this nature. It's fact. It's terrible. It's horrible what occurred.
You were there. You saw it.
I saw it, and will never be out of my mind.
Have you found anything that's helped you handle it better?
I think the most important thing to me has been for people to find out and know for sure that this is what happened and what went on, and we can't stand to have it again. That's, I think, the most important thing to me.
That's why you tell your story, in the hopes that people will learn and not let this happen again.
Yes, that's right. I don't try to make a deal of it or anything of that nature. But if it comes up, I don't hesitate to say something, because this generation of ours needs to understand those things can happen again. It's inhuman. It took me a long time, but I don't mind talking to groups or any other thing if that little bit would help prevent it from happening again.
You know, I wasn't going to ask you this, but hearing you discuss things the way you are and sharing it, I think you can handle this question. The young man that you gave that Luger to.
Yes.
Knowing anything can happen here. He could turn it around and shoot me. He can go kill whoever. And then hearing those shots and knowing that people are dying. Did you ever regret that or have remorse over that? Or wonder if you did the right thing?
No. The young man, he was so forceful. And the way he handled himself, he went right back into the fray. When we were there, he could have shot us and what have you. But something about it told me that he was telling me the truth. And then I was seeing the truth. As I said, I wake up at night still just remembering, mm-hmm. not worrying about it, but remembering. And I don't ever hesitate to talk to a group of people if they're willing to listen. So your being here and listening to me is much appreciated. It's hard to spread this kind of information without being thought of as maybe a damn fool or some other such thing.
Well, and I can feel in the way you're talking about it, the burden that you've carried for all these years. Know that it hasn't been easy.
No, it hasn't been easy. But I'd do it again if I had to.
Ralph Rush passed away last year at the age of 97. His account of the liberation of Ordruff is about as powerful as it gets. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to an account of that experience that Ralph wrote. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come as we remember the Holocaust today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode to remember the Holocaust. Maybe you've noticed that the date of Holocaust Remembrance Day moves around a bit from year to year. That's because it's dictated by the Hebrew calendar, and it falls on the 27th of Nisan and the start of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943. This year, that translated to April 21st, and perhaps you heard or saw references to it on the news this week. For the more than 500,000 Jewish Americans who served in uniform in World War II, the persecution of the Jewish people in Europe provided added motivation to fight. Growing up outside of Boston, Mel Friedman was familiar with Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism from an early age.
My father could understand Yiddish because his mother could speak Yiddish. My father was born in San Francisco, but his mother spoke Yiddish. And for some reason, he could understand an awful lot of Hitler's ravings, which were carried on the radio. And then there was a rogue priest named Father Coughlin, who had a program that my dad used to listen to and shake his head and said, I'd like to just have him between my two hands. So we were aware that antisemitism was just rampant throughout Europe, and it was starting to get real bad in the United States because the German Bund was created in New Jersey. There were German Nazis that were parading with flags and, you know, swastikas and so forth. And there were a number of other places that they came to light where Nazi sympathizers. Yeah, we were aware pretty much. My dad, my brother, who was 5 years older than me, we were pretty much aware of what was happening in the world and particularly to Jewish people.
You ended up in the Army at age 17?
Went to Fort McClellan, Anniston, Alabama for basic training, and then turned 18 while I was there and was offered the opportunity to go to OCS, but I was 18 years old. I mean, it seemed a little difficult for me when I looked around and saw some of the officers that had been training us were older and much more mature. And they also offered me an opportunity to go to college. So I said, I'll go to college. And so they sent us to Manhattan College in New York. We were there for 3 months, and then regimental combat team training. They needed foot soldiers in Europe, so back to the infantry.
When you think back on what your mindset might have been back then, did you feel some anticipation of going and doing something? Did you feel some anxiety that you were hoping you wouldn't get too close to the action? What do you think your mindset was as a teenager in the Army?
That's an awful tough thing to say, that you might be brave. You don't really ever know that you're brave. You only prove that you can be brave, or that you are brave. But I knew one thing. I wanted to kill Germans if I possibly could. I hated them with deep passion. One, because they interrupted my opportunity to go to college. And two, because of what they represented in the world. They represented evil. And I think almost every kid from my town that went in the service, and we had a lot of fatalities in my town. One family lost three boys, and the fourth son survived and married my high school girlfriend. The Lilja family, I think they were Finnish or Swedish or something, but great. What that family had to endure was, I didn't have to endure anything near what they did and what others did. I believe we were the greatest generation. We were called that. When you think about it, I guess the population of the United States was estimated at 130 million at the start of World War II, and our 300 million that we have today couldn't warm up what that generation was able to do, what they produced, food and instruments of war. They were just absolutely remarkable. I mean, how they did it, I don't know. All I know is that I was standing near some kind of a farm in Bavaria. The planes were from horizon to horizon. Our bombers just kept coming. And I remember thinking to myself, where the hell did we get all those planes from? You know, it's unimaginable when you've seen one. You know, how could we have produced all those things? Worst, number one, were the burning tanks at Nuremberg, got hit by the SS and the Tigers. It had already taken place, and we were told to grab our rifles and helmets, but the Germans had already retreated, so we were just looking at burning tanks and the horror of men and tanks. That part of it you don't want to remember. Who wants to remember? You don't want any of your people to hear that somebody remembered arms and legs and so forth. It's nothing that you want to know about. And I think if you talk to young people today, they wouldn't want to know about it either.
I'm certainly not one for graphic, grisly detail. But on the flip side of that, so many of us can easily go through our life in this country today and not realize how great the price that's been paid for our freedom is, and that people just like us. And was that what you experienced when you looked out at that, that you said, hey, that could have been me over there? That could have been my brother, my buddy?
Of course. Of course, you know, you didn't type a single name that you didn't think it could be you. You could hear German artillery and mortars with which they were so wonderfully accurate. But what the hell, they measured every inch that we were traversing, so they knew pretty much where you might dig in or where you might have your tanks located. So they, I don't know where they got all the ammunition, but boy, they sure had tons of it. And this is near the end of the war. And they still had anti-aircraft ammunition, which just, you know, you could hear it going bum, boom, bum, boom, bum, boom. The sound of an 88, you'll never forget. Their mortars were even worse. Screaming memes. Germans didn't mind a lot of things, you know, as we were moving across, particularly across Germany. I don't think they wanted to mine their own country. I think they had the mines. We were going through a wooded area, and we found these stone buildings. They weren't very large, about the size of a one-car garage, and with wooden roofs, by the way. And they were all filled with wooden bullets, boxes of wooden bullets. One of our officers at that time said that was against the Geneva Convention, you know, that you could not use wooden bullets, because wooden bullets were just horrifying to even think about. It was, I guess, equivalent to using gas again. Yeah. We were told that if you got hit by a wooden bullet, it just splintered. And there was no way they were ever going to remove all the splinters. But we found two of those buildings that were just stacked with these wooden bullets. Whether they ever used them, I don't know, but I never saw it.
There have been accounts of the Germans using wooden bullets and accounts of Americans having a tough time recovering from wounds produced by such bullets. So that, I guess, was a disturbing discovery for you guys. But there was something even worse than that, something the whole world began to slowly learn about in April of 1945, just how brutal the Nazi regime had been. How was it, Mel, that you ended up coming face-to-face with the haunting evidence of evil? How did you end up witnessing a recently liberated concentration camp?
I guess I was the lowest ranked guy in the headquarters company, so I was given a map and instructed to drive Father Kennedy, who was a rotund priest, and as it turned out, he came from Boston. So, and he was just a wonderful man. And I had to drive him to this place called a concentration camp.
Did you know that's where you were going, or you didn't realize it till you got there?
We guessed, you know. We guess that was someone from either division or army had said that inspection teams had to be sent. I guess so many clergymen, my guess is they just, you know, when they sit at desks and they can ponder, they come up with some awfully creative ideas about who should see these things and why they should see them. I don't think they visualized me seeing it. I think they visualized the priest seeing it. So,
what did you find when you got there? What did you see?
My guess, a football-sized pit. How deep, I don't know.
The size of a football field.
Yeah, the size of a football field. Sideline to sideline and end line to end line. Not goalpost line, end line to end line. I thought it looked like it was even bigger than a football field, but I read later that it was football field size, so I'm using that as a description. But it was just hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of bodies. Most of them just skin and bones, you know, but just randomly thrown into this pit. And I believe that most of them had been machine gunned or shot and fell in. And some were probably picked up by others who were going to be shot and thrown in. And by the way, it was covered with, had been covered with lime. Someone had ordered lime to be thrown over this pit, but you can't imagine the ovens. We saw, you know, human remains in the ovens and so forth. But that was a couple of other drivers and I walked around while the officers and so forth were. You didn't rub elbows with the officers, if you know what I meant. They were the ones standing around this huge pit, and we saw it and then kind of like moved away, and we went to see the, we didn't know they were there. We saw the ovens, the crematory ovens. We saw the gas. They gassed a lot of people. We saw those rooms. A paratrooper told us that that's where they had gassed thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Another paratrooper was the one who told us you got to see the ovens. And they only had, you know, like, as far as I can remember, like three big ovens. That's all I remember were three big ovens. They were all stone, by the way. They weren't brick or anything. They were stone. And we saw the ovens. And then the people who were standing around, leaning against the buildings and so forth, were just skeleton, you know, I mean, or skeletal.
Alive but emaciated.
Oh, I don't. Emaciated is too simplistic. Oh, they were. Well, I think you saw what happened to some of our troops that were released from German prison camps, who 150, 60-pound guys were down to 80 pounds, you know. Well, can you imagine what these poor people were? They were just there being prepared to get killed. They stripped them of everything, their hair, their teeth, you know.
What did that do to you, especially being of Jewish heritage, to see what had happened?
I didn't think in terms of Jewish. I could not conceive, as a kid, and a fairly intelligent kid. I wasn't a dummy. I was naive, but I wasn't dumb. I couldn't conceive of anybody being that cruel to anybody else. There has to be some of our generation left that were Italians, that were Greeks, that were Czechs, or Slovaks of some kind, Polish, because the Germans exterminated an awful lot of people besides Jews. I don't think the Germans took Russian prisoners. That's at least what I heard. So how can you not hate Germany for what they did to so many people? Yes, 6 million Jews was a huge percentage of the Jews in the world. But I just rode on a motorcycle with two friends, and one of them was an Armenian, and I think the Armenians have lost as many people to prejudice as the Jews might have lost in Europe. Millions of Armenians were slaughtered. Our history books don't tell us these things unless you go to Harvard.
That was a plug for his alma mater, because Mel Friedman did indeed go to Harvard after the war, thanks to the GI Bill. In fact, he played linebacker for the Crimson on the gridiron, which left him with some vivid memories of opponents like Joe Paterno as a player for Brown and Vince Lombardi as a coach for Army, but also of his Harvard teammate Robert F. Kennedy and his brother Jack. Again, that was World War II veteran Mel Friedman. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a man who escaped the Holocaust, came to America, went back to Europe with the U.S. Army, only to learn eventually that many of his family members had died at the hands of the Nazis. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Holocaust Remembrance episode this week. Dr. Oscar Cully Rice passed away last year, just shy of his 98th birthday. I really wish he were still with us, because I'd love to hear his perspective on the coronavirus pandemic. I know it would have been right up his alley. An acclaimed scientist and researcher who, among many other pioneering achievements, played a significant role in the development of the PSA test for prostate cancer, Dr. Rice never would have been Dr. Rice if he didn't survive being wounded in World War II. And before that, he had to escape his native Germany. Born to a Jewish family in Bad Dürkheim, most of his formative years were spent in the suburbs of Munich.
Interestingly enough, I went, of course, to a Catholic grammar school. But then Hitler, in 33 or 4, decreed that Jews had to go to Jewish schools. Uh-huh. So then I went to an Orthodox Jewish school in Munich. And then after that, after I graduated, I went to Altus Real Gymnasium, which is the same thing as a high school, but much more advanced. So until Hitler gave in the full power, till 35, 36, there was no problem go to the school. But the Hitler Youth started to really harass me, us, the Jewish people. In wintertime, they throw snowballs at us that had rocks in it. Mm. And I went to school in a bicycle. They were in the air of the bicycle, ruining the bicycles too. And then one of the Hitler Youth that sat behind me was carrying a long knife, stick the knife in my back, and said, when there were tests, especially math tests, where I was very good at, let's change tests.
Wow.
So my mother, father said, you got to get out of here. So I applied both for a visa to the United States and for a visa to go to Palestine. I had a very close friend, high school friend, Richard Blatchest. When I got the visa to come to the United States, I wanted to go with him, of course. But my mother says, you're going to the United States. So at 17 in those days, you don't disagree with your parents.
Well, yeah. But they're telling you it's not safe for you here. You have to go to America. You don't speak any English.
Yeah.
So you're sailing across the Atlantic Ocean.
But she knew where I was going because her aunt, who sponsored me, had connections with the ag school I went to.
An ag school that's now called Delaware Valley
University.
What you studied there was how to be a dairyman, right?
Well, that was my major. I also learned how to do other work, like to plow fields and spray orchard. They had five different departments.
Uh-huh.
What helped me with my English was the head of floriculture had got his degree from Heidelberg University and was fluent in German.
Uh-huh.
So as long as I was with him in the department, he helped me with my language.
So you picked up English pretty quick.
Yes. In 6 months, it was all right.
So you're over here. Your whole family is still in Germany. You're studying at this basically agricultural school, National Farm School it was called then. You end up getting out of there and running a dairy. But over this time period, how often did you hear from your family back home?
Very rarely, very rarely.
You had to be concerned about him, knowing what Hitler was about.
Of course. Then I asked my aunt to also give him visas, and she applied for it. But by the time the mail got to my parents, the American embassy in Stuttgart had closed because of the war, and there was nothing to be done anymore.
And if your parents had waited a year, 2 years longer, you might not have made it to America.
Right.
But your little sister did.
Yeah. She went through southern France. But she was so traumatized, she didn't remember how the whole thing happened.
Your parents had the foresight to help you flee this situation, but they were stuck there.
And my sister, because we had relatives in Alsace-Lorraine, and they sent my sister, after the war has broken out, to Alsace-Lorraine. And then she went to southern France, around Marseille somewhere, and came to the United States.
Yeah, so here you've graduated from this university, and now you're running a dairy farm in Maryland, not far from Washington, D.C. You did that for a couple years. They didn't need you for the war. They needed you in that job. And then when you decided that you might want to get in this war and go fight the man who's persecuting your family and so many others, they said, no, you can't. You're an enemy.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's happened to your family, right?
No, right. Absolutely no idea.
And you've got both your parents and your brother are still back there.
And my grandparents.
And your grandparents.
All my grandparents.
And I can't imagine what that feels like, to be completely cut off and no idea and knowing that people are being persecuted and horrible things are happening. But by 1943, they decide, we changed our mind. We need some bodies now.
Well, the reason is that I worked in the creamery, so I wasn't essential anymore.
So since you stopped working at the creamery, you didn't have an exemption anymore?
Well, I don't know. I just got a letter from the draft board.
Uh-huh.
We report for induction.
But you're still not a U.S. citizen.
Nope.
You go into the Army. You're training.
Fort McCallum.
So you're out there shooting a machine gun?
Yeah.
And what did they do? They had you change targets real fast or something?
Yeah.
And they noticed how good you were at that?
Yeah.
Because you were real sharp in math. You could make the adjustments.
Yeah.
And so then they came to talk to you.
Yeah.
And they heard your accent.
Yeah.
What happened then?
Well, he said, we need you in Germany.
He realized you spoke German.
Yeah, fluent German. He says, we need you in Germany.
And he meant right then.
Right there. And he says, we can't send you because you're not a citizen. We got to make you a citizen.
So how'd they do that?
Well, they took me to a courthouse in Anniston, Alabama. The colonel went to see the judge and explained the situation to him. After I had filled out all the forms, I went into the judge's chamber. And the judge looked at me and says, do you know anything about the Constitution? And I waved my pamphlet the Army had given me and says, yes, I've read it. And he said, you're a citizen.
Just like that.
And 3 weeks later, I was in Germany.
They put you in the 79th Infantry Division.
Yeah.
You got there right as the Battle of the Bulge is going on,
right? Right. We were protecting the right flank of Patton in the Battle of the Bulge.
Now, you had grown up in Germany. I know. I'm sure you'd had some rough winters.
Oh, yeah.
But what was that like, that winter of 44?
Digging a foxhole was terrible. It wasn't nice, let me put it this way. But I managed all right. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, I told all my companions to not call me Oscar, my first name, because it's so Germanic. I used my middle name, Kully, K-U-L-L-Y.
Uh-huh.
That's my mother's maiden name was Kullmann. So that's why I'm Kully. Then I could overhear a lot of the German conversations, which helped us so strategically.
So if you had gone by Oscar, the enemy would have been tipped off and wouldn't have spoken German so freely.
Yeah.
But you're in a combat situation.
Oh, yeah.
You've got the enemy firing at you, and you're firing at them.
Oh, yeah. I went through a night patrol with an American Indian, a corporal. I learned how to behave in the woods at night. He knew his way around. He's the one that taught me how to stay alive under those conditions.
Did you think you were going to stay alive?
I had doubts because we were getting attacked by tanks and all this sort of thing.
And how often? I mean, here you are.
Yeah.
You're back in Europe. You're so close to your family, in theory.
Yeah.
But you still don't know what's happened to them.
Right.
How often did you think about that?
Oh, constantly, of course.
And you're fighting this regime that is the reason you left Germany.
Well, yeah. That had something to do with my motivation. I rewarded the Silver Star.
You mentioned the Silver Star. So this takes place long after the Battle of the Bulge, after you guys, by hook or by crook, made it across the Rhine, which wasn't easy for you. And you're in a foxhole looking out, and what do you see?
I see movement where I know what people, and in a foxhole, I know it was on the German side, so it must have been Germans.
And how far away were they?
100 yards.
And how many of them were there?
Well, actually, two. The army said three, but it was only two.
And what did you decide to do?
I decided to take my radio off and crawl in a ditch with my carbine. That took me within, maybe 5 feet of that foxhole and got out. Cocked my carbine first, of course. Jumped out of the foxhole and told them the Germans to surrender.
And you said that in German?
In German, yeah.
Yeah.
And they immediately surrendered. Didn't have to do anything.
But that's a long way to crawl. And if you had alerted them somehow with some mistake before you got there, they would have shot you.
Yeah, of course.
So you were taking your life into your hands by doing this.
There's no question about that.
So you tell them to surrender. They do. And you say, now you have to follow me back over here.
Yeah, I follow you.
You force them to go. Yeah, exactly. And you notice something in their possession.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons you got the Silver Star.
Yeah.
Tell me what you found.
I found a German map that had marked clearly the coordinates of the guns that they were using to destroy the pontoon bridge.
And this is why you had such a hard time getting across the Rhine.
Yeah.
They kept blowing up the pontoon bridge or the engineers' efforts to build one.
Yeah.
You discover this map that's got the gun positions.
We radioed back immediately the coordinates of the gun position.
And what happened next?
The guns started firing.
Not just any guns.
No, those were the kinds of size that the battleships had. They were sitting on the other side of the Rhine. They had to be taken apart. They were not type of guns that couldn't move. There was emplacements.
That's why I'm asking, because when people hear big guns, they think we're talking about maybe at most a 155.
Yeah.
This is a 250?
50 millimeter, yeah. At least that's what they told me. And they had to be taken apart into three pieces to be transported.
But they know exactly where to fire because of the map that you found.
Yeah.
So here you are back in your position, and you've got quite a show to behold.
Yeah.
Tell me what you saw and what you heard.
Well, they told us to get our heads down in the foxhole in case there was a short round, and they started firing for 15 minutes, TOT, time on target, and the shells going overhead sounded like a freight train going overhead. And I learned later I didn't see the place, but the friends of mine that saw the place where the guns were said they were totally destroyed.
I would imagine so, with artillery of that caliber heading their way. And that's significant. I mean, the reason they're giving you the Silver Star is by capturing these guys, finding that map, they're able to destroy all these guns.
Yeah.
That allows them to get across the Rhine, and it probably saved a lot of American lives.
Sure.
Did you realize that at the time, how significant that was?
No, I didn't. That was a job. You know, when you're on the front line, see what a job that needs to be done. You don't worry about anything else. They say, how can I get it done? and saved my life.
Just 3 days after those heroics that earned him the Silver Star, he was wounded by shrapnel from a mortar shell. He always said the radio strapped to his back probably saved his life by protecting his internal organs. But through all of those harrowing days in combat, even crossing back into his native Germany, he still had no report, no information, no final word on what had become of his family there that he'd been forced to leave behind.
No. Not until I went to Munich to the headquarters where all the records were kept and looked at the records. And I found out later the records were not accurate.
Well, I want to understand what this was like for you. And again, keeping in mind that you're still a very young man. So you're ordered to Nuremberg and they're going to have you interrogate war criminals because you speak such great German.
Yeah.
Now, these are the war criminals that wanted to kill you and any other Jew they could find.
Yeah.
But to that point, you were okay with that idea.
I was hesitant even then.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say. I was not ready to tell my colonel no.
Sure.
But after seeing the records.
So tell me about this. So you go to Munich, and what's in Munich?
All the records are kept in Munich.
And you mean all the records from the entire Holocaust?
Yeah. They were later transferred to another place, and any correction were made. The Holocaust was the same in Washington. Put me up to that, to go to the records at the other place.
Uh-huh.
To make sure, like they had, my parents were loaded in a cattle train, and in Munich it said they were taken to Riga, Latvia, executed there, but the train never made it to Riga. It stopped.
What I want to understand is what knowledge you are receiving at the time, because you get to Munich. And here is this vast trove of records. Was it a needle in a haystack to find your family in there?
No, no. It was filed under my regular name, Rice.
So you look up Rice.
Yeah.
And as you get to that spot, is your heart pounding a little bit? Or did you think you already knew what you were going to find?
I think I knew what I was going to find. I had enough stories. When we went across from the Rhine to Czechoslovakia, we were very close to the Belsen concentration.
Bergen-Belsen,
Bergen-Belsen. And there, you know, in the army, rumors fly. We knew that it was very bad.
But now you're opening up a file.
Yeah.
And you see right there, and it has your parents' name.
Yeah, it's in here. The only thing that was wrong is that it didn't go to Riga. The gate went to Kaunas.
But you're looking at a paper that says your parents are dead.
Yeah, and my grandparents. My grandparents went to Theresienstadt.
And what about your brother?
Oh, he went with my parents.
What did that do to you, to see that in print?
Oh, it's hard to take, let's put it this way. If I would have had a German that was bothering me, I might have shot him, without question.
So you find out that your parents, your grandparents, your brother are all victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're also thinking at some point, that's what would have happened to me.
Sure.
Yet you go back to Nuremberg, and they still expect you to interrogate these guys.
Yeah.
So what'd you do?
I told the colonel I couldn't do it emotionally, and he understood.
You did some things in the army in World War II that saved fellow soldiers' lives. The lives you most desperately wanted to save, your family, you couldn't because of Hitler. And now, all these years later, you develop a test that, I mean, I have to imagine, has helped save thousands of lives, if not millions.
Well, that's why I went to science, helped do some social work, to try to find out what's going on in your body and what we can do to improve diseases.
Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever tried to quantify
how
many people have survived or been able to treat prostate cancer because they got warning?
No, I don't know.
Do you think I'm off in my estimate?
I don't think so. It makes me feel proud that I was able to contribute something.
And ultimately, on that end, I guess we have your parents to thank for their foresight in sending you to this country.
Especially my mother, who constantly said to me, get educated. That's something they never can take away from you. That's who gets credit for it.
Dr. Oscar Coley Rice honored his mother and other family members by having memorial trees planted in their honor in the Martyrs Forest. That's just outside Jerusalem, where Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Remembrance Center, contains a few items that Dr. Rice donated. The memories he shared on Hometown Heroes are now part of the collection of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. With each passing year, Holocaust Remembrance Day arrives with fewer and fewer men and women who survived it or witnessed it, still here to tell that story. If you know anyone in those categories, why don't you ask them to share their stories? If they're willing, record their memories so future generations will know. Because once we really know, we have no excuse for ever allowing it to happen again. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more, as those three veterans whose memories you heard today knew oh so well, that freedom is not free.